This is day five of this July 2015 7-day session. We'll return to the book we started on yesterday called The Zen Teaching of Hui Hai on Sudden Illumination, translated by John Blofeld. Hui Hai lived in the 700s and was a disciple, one of the 139 enlightened disciples of the great Ma Zhu. But it's not the same as the much more famous Hui Hai, which is Baijiang Hui Hai, known in Japan as Hyakujo. We were reading from his teachings in dialogue form. The venerable Dao Quang, who was an adherent of the Dharma Laksana school, apparently that's a school that holds that consciousness is real, and also a commentator upon the sutras, inquired, "Master, what mental processes do you employ in pursuing the way?" "Master, I have no mental processes that would be of use and no way to follow." Question: if both those statements are true, why is it that every day you convene gatherings during which you urge others to learn how to follow the way by means of Chan? I think it makes these dialogues a little more meaningful to consider that some of them, maybe most of them, the questions are cooked up by these brilliant scholars who are trying to trap the master. Why is it that every day you convene gatherings of your students? "Master, this old monk does not possess even a dot of ground in which to stick an awl, so how can he gather people? He does not have so much as a tongue, then how can he urge people to do anything?" Again, he's emphasizing the emptiness aspect of all phenomena. Answer: "Why, Master, you are lying to my face." "Master, how can this old monk, being without a tongue to urge people, tell a lie?" Question: "Really, I do not understand the way the Venerable Chan Master talks." "Master, nor does this old monk understand himself." If he understood himself, then he wouldn't really know himself. If he knew himself, he wouldn't really know himself. What self is fixed? What fixed self can be known? How can we know what is shimmering energy in flux, evanescent? Someone asked, "Is prajna very large?" Prajna is wisdom, but not just. Many Buddhist texts, they'll use prajna to refer to knowledge, knowledge gained from deep study of the sutras. They'll use wisdom to refer to what we would call knowledge, study. But prajna specifically means transcendental wisdom, is having experiential wisdom, having seen the non-dual nature of reality. Is prajna very large? Master, it is. How large? Unlimited. Is prajna small? It is. How small? So small as to be invisible. Where is it? Where is it not? He's pointing out that this prajna mind, this essential nature, could never be limited to one place. Couldn't be limited, period. It is our nature. Our nature is wisdom. Our fundamental, our essence is wisdom. We couldn't get away from it if we tried. In this practice, we're mining this wisdom. We're uncovering it, discovering it. But there's nowhere else it could be found than right here. Now I'm going back. What we were reading from was the second section of this book, the Tsung Ching record. And now I'm going back to the first section, also, which has some dialogues in dialogue form, and selecting some of those. Question: what are the three methods of training to be performed at the same level? That's the name of this doctrine, the three methods of training to be performed at the same level, and what is meant by performing them on the same level. Now, this is Blofeld's translation, the three methods of training. More commonly, I see it as the three essentials. I wrote a very short article for one of these Buddhist magazines earlier this year, in which I laid out these three essentials, which are Shila, S-I-L-A, means upright conduct or discipline. Sometimes it's translated as discipline, upright conduct. Meditation, which the translator here is rendering as concentration. And wisdom, prajna, wisdom. And how these, in any truly mature practice of the Dharma, these three must stand as like a three-legged stool to support practice. Any one of these three that is neglected will render one's practice and one's understanding as deficient. So again, the question, what are these three methods of training, or the three essentials? Answer, they are discipline, concentration, and wisdom. Oh, excuse me. The first one, discipline, he's using as a translation, not for Shila, but Vinaya. Vinaya being monastic rules and regulations. Let's go with this then. Question, please explain them one by one. Discipline involves stainless purity. Uh, here, purity, well, there's a footnote here, and I'll comment on that if it seems helpful. The translator says, purity means something much more than the moral purity normally implied by this term in English. It means freedom from all attachment and discrimination whatsoever. It would be marred by attachment to good. It would be marred by attachment to good as much as by attachment to bad. So we could call it kind of a non-attachment. Discipline involves stainless purity. Concentration, that's the second of these three essentials, involves the stilling of your minds so that you remain wholly unmoved by surrounding phenomena. This is what we develop in Zazen generally, but especially rapidly in Sesshin, where we can find ourselves undistracted by anything going on around us, so concentrated we get. Wisdom, the third, means that your stillness of mind is not disturbed by your giving any thought to that stillness, that your purity is unmarred by your entertaining any thought of purity, and that in the midst of all such pairs of opposites as good and evil, you are able to distinguish between them without being stained by them, and in this way to reach the state of being perfectly at ease and free of all dependence. Furthermore, if you realize that discipline, concentration, and wisdom are all alike in that their substance is intangible, and that hence they are undivided and therefore one, that is what is meant by three methods of training performed at the same level. You can't do much better as far as a formula for success in Zen practice. You can't do much better than to honor these three. Living up to the precepts as the foundation of one's practice, because if you're violating precepts, then you're more likely your meditation will suffer, and you're less likely to be able to realize your true nature, the prajna wisdom. Concentration is all but essential for not losing one's way in conduct and to break through into prajna wisdom. And prajna wisdom lifts the other two, discipline and concentration, to a transcendent level. So these three are mutually supportive. Question. When the mind rests in a state of purity, or we said non-attachment, will that not give rise to some attachment to purity? Answer. If, on reaching the state of purity, you refrain from thinking, now my mind is resting in purity, there will be no such attachment. It's a very important point. The mind is always ready to seize for itself whatever gains we find in our practice. So if you stumble into a state of this kind of pure non-attachment to thoughts, then right there the mind is ready to pat you on the back and say, way to go. This is, now you're getting somewhere, right? And with that very intervention by the mind, we go astray. Question, when the mind rests in a state of void, will that not entail some attachment to void? Answer, if you think of your mind as resting in a state of void, then there will be such an attachment, because it's a thought. If you think of your mind, so that means self-consciousness, conceiving of yourself in that state, well, then you're no longer in that state. This is another common pitfall for those who do experience a state of what we call emptiness of the mind, is right away the mind is ready to pounce with that, oh, now this is must be what they mean by emptiness. Cool, now I'm getting somewhere. This makes this so difficult, this progress, because there are always these ambushes by the mind that are possible. Question, when the mind reaches the state of not dwelling upon anything and continues in that state, will there not be some attachment to its not dwelling upon anything? Answer, so long as your mind is fixed solely on void, there is nothing to which you can attach yourself. Let's tackle this word void. It seems to be more common in the early books on Zen, translated into English. This is one of the earliest. Let's get a date on this. 1962. The early translators favor the word void over emptiness. The problem with void is it sounds so definite. It sounds so discreet, like a place that one can go, a space between things, or a space out beyond things, like the far reaches of outer space. I think this is what we commonly bring to mind when we see the word void, the blackness of deep space. With a worst kind of image is a poor astronaut untethered and tumbling through the void. It sounds void. It's such that D on the end. It makes it sound so, well, discreet, like a wood or shed or hood or something. And that's why I think emptiness is a better word. Any word misses it, of course, because as soon as you have a word, you have finiteness. You have it's delineated. Emptiness, then, that's a certain word that suggests that there is this place that is delineated from things, from form. But at least emptiness is a kind of more of a generalized word. Abstract, yes, that's what's against it, but still it has more of a sense of, more easily see it as informing the world of form rather than being apart from the world of form. But let's stick with this for this reading. He says, so long as your mind is fixed solely on void, that is, your you're dwelling in emptiness, the emptiness of the mind, beyond thought, that means, there is nothing to which you can attach yourself. If you want to understand the non-dwelling mind very clearly, while you are actually sitting in meditation, you must be cognizant only of the mind and not permit yourself to make judgments. That is, you must avoid evaluations in terms of good, evil, or anything else. This is another way that the mind ambushes us when we're getting into these deep places, is just saying, this is good. What you did in the past is bad, now this is good. And there again, there's the division of this mind. He continues, whatever is past, so do not sit in judgment upon it. For when thinking about the past ceases of itself, it can be said that there is no longer any past. Whatever is in the future is not here yet, so do not direct your hopes and longings towards it. For when thinking about the future ceases of itself, it can be said that there is no future. Whatever is present is now at hand. Just be conscious of your non-attachment to everything. Non-attachment in the sense of not allowing any love or aversion for anything to enter your mind. For when thinking about the present ceases of itself, we may say that there is no present. When there is no clinging to any of those three periods, they may be said not to exist. So this is a phrase that you run across in Buddhist texts, the non-existence of the three times, past, present, and future. And what this means is the perspective of one who has no thoughts of past, no thoughts of future, not even thoughts of the present. This is a marvelous state of freedom, where the mind is unscored by thoughts of past, present, or future. In this state, there's no time at all. This could be called reaching the eternal. Doesn't mean you stay there. This is what I think you could call samadhi. And samadhi can come and go. But to experience this, to taste this realm that is beyond all thought, beyond divisions, is enough to keep on practicing for decades. It's this state of emptiness, the utter purity of the mind, unmarred by past, present, and future or anything else. This is the precondition for awakening. But it can be just an instant of it. Doesn't have to be hours of this realm, but can just turn all of a sudden. And that's the other trap. So when reaching this state, to have any thought about it being the precondition for awakening is another way of getting clipped. He continues, should your mind wander, do not follow it, whereupon your wandering mind will stop wandering of its own accord. Should your mind desire to linger somewhere, do not follow it and do not dwell there, whereupon your mind's questing for a dwelling place will cease of its own accord. So the quest for a dwelling place could very well be wanting to dwell in non-dwelling, wanting to dwell in emptiness. And that's also a trap. Thereby you will come to possess a non-dwelling mind, a mind which remains in the state of non-dwelling. If you are fully aware in yourself of a non-dwelling mind, you will discover that there is just the fact of dwelling with nothing to dwell upon or not to dwell upon. In other words, if then there is awareness, you're not in a state of oblivion, there's awareness, but there is no thought. Then there is just this dwelling and non-dwelling in emptiness. This full awareness in yourself of a mind dwelling upon nothing is known as having a clear perception of your own mind, or, in other words, as having a clear perception of your own nature. A mind which dwells upon nothing is the Buddha mind, the mind of one already liberated, Bodhi mind, uncreated mind, unborn mind. It is also called realization that the nature of all appearances is unreal. The nature of all appearances is unreal. So as we go on in Sesshin and deepening concentration, we see that the machinations of the mind become more and more subtle. We discover how subtle they are in seeing oneself, the observer that is always there until it isn't. If you have not realized it yet, you must strive and strive. You must increase your exertions. Then when your efforts are crowned with success, you will have attained to understanding from within yourself, an understanding stemming from a mind that abides nowhere, by which we mean a mind free from delusion and reality alike, that is, free from notions, ideas of delusion and reality. A mind disturbed by love and aversion is deluded. A mind free from both of them is real. And a mind thus freed reaches the state in which opposites are seen as void, whereby freedom and liberation are obtained. His translation of this dichotomy of love and aversion, I think it's love is an unfortunate translation. It's almost always these two are translated as likes and dislikes, or desire and aversion. It's not that we, as long as we have bodies, we will be subject to desires. The most obvious is hunger, wanting food, wanting sleep, wanting water, even wanting sex. The problem, seen from a Zen perspective, is not desire itself, but our attachment to our desires. Getting caught in them. If we don't fight them and we don't cling to our desires, then they arise and they fall away. This we discover experientially in Zazen. When, for example, we have an itch while we're sitting in a formal round and there's no moving allowed, we have an itch, well, we find if we don't scratch it, that it will pass. This is one of the countless little ways that we learn the Dharma, the impermanence of things. Or when we get clobbered by some strong emotional state, if we don't try to suppress it, nor wallow in it, cling to it, that too we will find passes. Everything, all phenomena, if we have the eyes to see, we will see are transitory. If we had the freedom to scratch that itch, then we wouldn't find, we wouldn't see for ourselves that it passes. Well, we certainly have the freedom to pursue our thoughts, but that gets old after a while. Question, is there really a hell? On one of my pilgrimages in China, I saw a number of vivid, frightening depictions of the Buddhist hells in paintings and in sculptures. So this was part of the popular Buddhism. It's probably part of just about every religion on a popular level. So this is not an uncommon question. We run across this and sometimes in other texts as well. Is there really a hell? Answer, there is and there is not. How so? In that our minds have constructed many sorts of evil karma, there is hell. But since everyone's self-nature is void, for those whose minds have been freed of attachment's stains, there can be no hell. It is one of the six realms of unenlightened existence, hell. But a huge difference between this idea of hell in Buddhism and hell in other religions, some other religions, is that it's not permanent. You don't land in pitch black everlasting hell. You pass through. Like everything else, hell is transitory. It's an impermanent state. And we don't have to. What hell all too often conjures up for so many of us, even for me, when I never even had any religious background, is fires of hell. And these are from the New Yorker cartoons, maybe. The devils with their spears and the fires, the flames. Leaping up here and there. Question, do evildoers possess Buddha nature? I hope you all can answer this. Answer, yes, they have it too. Question, then if they too have this nature, does it enter hell with them or not? Answer, it does not enter with them. Question, but when they enter hell, where is their Buddha nature? It also enters hell. There, take that. Well, he started off by saying, as far as hell, that there is and there is not. It enters and it doesn't enter. What is not, what is not is. If this is not yet clear to you, you're still far from the inner truth. The problem with the idea of it entering, Buddha nature entering hell, is that hell is also Buddha nature. There's nothing apart from, outside Buddha nature. So how can that which is limitless enter anything else? Yet it's not apart from hellish states of existence, hellish mental states, hellish physical states of war and slavery and abuse. So, answer, it also enters hell. Question, that being so, while they are undergoing punishment there, does their Buddha nature share the punishment? No. Although Buddha nature remains with these people while they are in hell, it is the individuals themselves who suffer. The Buddha nature is fundamentally beyond punishment. I think here what we see is him accommodating his answers to a questioner who wouldn't understand the idea of Buddha nature as being beyond entering and leaving, beyond coming and going. So he's stepping down in order to try to reach this questioner. Again, the Buddha nature is fundamentally beyond punishment. Question, yet if they enter together, how can the Buddha nature not suffer? Answer, sentient beings possess forms, and whatsoever has form is subject to formation and destruction, whereas the Buddha nature is formless, and being formless is immaterial. For which reason, it is the very nature of the void itself and cannot be destroyed. And then he gives this analogy. Were someone to make a pile of sticks in a vacuum, the sticks could come to harm, but not the vacuum. In this analogy, the vacuum symbolizes Buddha nature and the sticks represent sentient beings. Therefore, it is written, they enter together, but do not suffer together. Question, is the nature of the absolute a true void or not really void? To describe it as not void is to imply that it has form. Yet to speak of it as void implies extinction, mere nothingness. And what would then be left for sentient beings to rely on in their practice for attaining liberation? That's another word for the void. A more philosophical word is the absolute. Again, there are these two sides to everything. There's the absolute and the relative. The non-differentiated and the differentiated. So the absolute is the formless, the void, and the other is form, phenomena. So, is the absolute a true void, or not really void? Answer, the nature of the absolute is void, and yet not void. How so? The marvelous substance of the absolute, substance is in quotes, having neither form nor shape, is therefore undiscoverable. Hence, it is void. Nevertheless, that immaterial formless substance contains functions as numerous as the sands of the Ganges, functions which respond unfailingly to circumstances, so it is also described as not void. This is an important point about Buddhist, the Dharma, that to say something is empty does not mean it doesn't have function. All of us are empty, and yet we function. This is the dual nature of reality. He quotes a sutra, "Understand the one point and the thousand others will accordingly grow clear. Misunderstand that one and 10,000 delusions will encompass you. He who holds to that one has no more problems to solve." That's the end of the sutra quote. Then he says, as one of the sutras says, "The myriad forms, dense and close, bear the imprint of a single Dharma." And then he says, "How then can so many sorts of views arise from the one Dharma? All these karmic forces are rooted in activity. If instead of pacifying our minds, we rely on sutras to achieve enlightenment, we are undertaking the impossible. Ourselves deceived, deceiving others, our mutual downfall is assured. Strive on, strive on. Explore this teaching most thoroughly. Just let things happen without making any response and keep your minds from dwelling on anything whatsoever. For he who can do this thereby enters nirvana. Attained, then, is the condition of no rebirth, otherwise called the gate of non-duality, the end of strife, the samadhi of universality." So the questioners keep wanting to split form and emptiness. But we know from the Prajnaparamita that form is only emptiness, and emptiness is only form. They are non-dual. There is function. The so-called emptiness functions through form. He continues, "I have written this treatise for the sake of those having a karmic affinity with it. I seek neither fame nor wealth. Do not seek for empty fame, mouthing forth talk of the absolute with minds like those of apes. When talk contradicts actions, that is known as self-deception. It will lead to your falling headlong into evil states of rebirth." Let me pause there and comment. He's warning about those who talk about what they haven't experienced or what they haven't confirmed through their own experience. "Seek not fame and happiness in this lifetime at the cost of unenlightenment and suffering for long eons to come." It might be in here the message of, don't try to become teachers and big shots and talk about what you haven't experienced. "Seek not fame and happiness at the cost of unenlightenment and suffering. Strive on, strive on. Sentient beings must liberate themselves. The Buddhas cannot do it for them. If they could, since there have already been Buddhas as numerous as grains of dust, every single being must by now have been liberated. Then how is it that you and I are still being tossed upon the waves of life and death instead of having become Buddhas? Do please realize that sentient beings have to liberate themselves and that the Buddhas cannot do it for them. Strive on, strive on. Do it for yourselves. Place no reliance upon the powers of other Buddhas." just one final thing here. Notice that he said, how is it that you and I are still being tossed upon the waves of life and death instead of having become Buddhas? Here he's using the word Buddha in the absolute sense of complete, perfect enlightenment. Clearly, Hui Hai himself is a man of deep enlightenment, but it's not complete, it's not absolute. He's still working. He still has a body, and having a body, he is bound to suffer. This is a revolutionary teaching when to those who have been taught that you would just need to call upon the name of the Buddha's name to be liberated, or to look to others for your liberation. Looking to the power of the Buddhas to come to enlightenment. As long as they do that, then they're just caught in delusion. Our time is up. We'll stop and recite the four vows.